Well,
do you have? Go ahead.
Go ahead. You're going to say something.
No, I was going to wrap it up. So if you got something more to say.
No. And there's the cold open. Welcome to The Geek in Review, the podcast focused on innovative and creative ideas in the legal industry. I'm Marlene Gebauer.
And I'm Greg Lambert. Well, Marlene, you have a session next week and where you're presenting at ILTACON. Are you ready and packed for the National Harbor?
Yeah, I'm getting there. It's like I'm traveling light because I have a few other stops before I actually get to National Harbor. So I'll be stopping in Chicago and then there and then flying back. So
wow, sounds busy.
Yeah, very busy next week. But the session that I'm going to be co-presenting with Danette Schaefer from Traveling Coaches is Couch to 5K, Learning Strategies to Transform Your Training Program.
Yeah.
So we're on Wednesday at 4 p.m., I think. So, you know, if you guys are still there, please come by. We'd love to have you.
I think I have a phone on or an app on my phone that, that does from couch to 5K, but I've never actually opened it.
Well, there's your first problem.
There's your problem.
So this week, we bring in Laura Leopard from Leopard Solutions to discuss the data her company began uncovering at the end of last year, where over 2,500 women lawyers left their jobs during the pandemic and apparently did not reenter the profession like most of their male counterparts did. Leopard Solutions' Women Leaving Law Survey dives into the different data points and a survey of women from the Am Law 200 firms to find out the reasons behind this exodus of women from big law.
But before we get into that, we have a familiar voice to many of us in the legal technology industry this week to answer our crystal ball question back from the AALL conference. And that is Bob Ambrogi from the Law Next podcast and LawSites blog peers into his crystal ball and talks about the changes in the legal regulatory sandboxes. So we'll hear from Bob, and then we'll go straight into our session with Laura Leopard on why women are leaving law. I am here in Denver at AALL with Bob Ambrogi, my second favorite legal podcaster out there in the whole world. Bob, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Greg, for having me. And as you know, you are my second favorite podcaster in the whole world.
I appreciate it. So, Bob, brought you in, sat you down to ask you our crystal ball question, which is pull out your crystal ball and kind of look into the legal industry, some aspect of it that you're interested in. And what are some things, say, in the next 2 to 5 years that you see are changes or challenges that people should be aware of?
I have to believe that the changes that are going to have the most impact on the legal profession over the next couple of years involve regulatory reform. And we've seen already more than the seeds, I was going to say the seeds, but more than the seeds in Utah and Arizona, where Utah has created the sort of regulatory sandbox, and Arizona has gone even farther and enacted a number of reforms that are allowing a greater range in terms of who can actually deliver legal services. Mm-hmm. So I think that the significance of that is in part that it's certainly going to help address the access to justice issue. I think that's why they're trying to do these initiatives in the first place. But ultimately, it's really going to have an impact across all types of legal practice as private companies can get involved in owning law firms or owning legal practices or delivering legal services, whether you're a low-income client or a major corporate client. I think we're going to see major changes come about as a result of that over the next few years.
Which states do you think are probably the most likely to test the waters on that next?
Well, that's the $10,000 question, really. You know, when Utah and Arizona initiated their reforms in pretty short order, one after the other, and I remember talking at the time to one of the justices from Arizona about whether these were the dominoes that were going to start falling in all the other states. But the dominoes haven't been falling. And in fact, just here at this convention, the Chief Justice of the California Supreme Court was here. And I asked her during her keynote about why California seems to be stuck on this issue. I think early on, everybody thought California would probably be the state that would lead the way on this. And
of course, if
California does, then a lot of states are going to follow, because California is really probably the biggest state in terms of numbers of lawyers. And she gave a little bit of a evasive answer, I think, in a sense. She kind of attributed it to legislative bottlenecks relating to the fact that the state legislature has to approve attorneys' dues every year, and they're putting conditions in that are making it impossible to carry forward some of these regulatory reforms. But so California is probably not the next. And
right.
Beyond that,
it didn't sound very promising.
Michigan has been talking a lot. Yeah. I mean, other states are working on this. I don't know. And I've been so kind of surprised that it's been slowed for a little bit of a period here, but I do think over the next year or two, we're going to start to see activity picking up again.
Okay. Well, Bob, thanks for dropping by and talking to me.
Yeah, always a pleasure.
We'd like to welcome Laura Leopard, founder and CEO of Leopard Solutions. Laura, glad to have you here on the Geek in Review.
Well, thank you so much. I'm very happy to be here.
So, Laura, Leopard Solutions is widely known in the industry for its monitoring and tracking of lawyers across the U.S. and global markets. And I know we deal with it a lot, because I do a lot with the lateral recruiting here, and our team loves the product. However, with that to the side, what we really brought you on here was to discuss a trend that your team uncovered last year, toward the end of the year, when it came to women lawyers who left legal practice and apparently didn't return. So what type of data was your team collecting, and how did they come to this conclusion that women were leaving law and not coming back?
Well, at the end of 2021, we started preparing data for our year-end roundup, where we just tell everybody what happened in the last year. And we had a chart of ethnically diverse attorneys who had left the top 200, and we saw where they had landed and where they had not landed. Then we looked at the data for women, and we saw that there was a pretty wide gap between those two groups of women re-entering big law or law of any kind, because at that time, there was a really big number of women with an unknown quantity, and that was they didn't return to a law firm we cover. We cover over 4,200 law firms. They didn't enter any of the 8,000 companies that we cover in our in-house database. They really just weren't anywhere. So it really piqued our curiosity. And we decided, well, let's see if we can find out. So I put a research team on going to look at those unknowns to see where they might have gone. And I was happy to report later that a lot of them did return to a job in legal, whether it was a company or academia or somewhere. It just took them a little while to do it. So a little gap in that employment. But that's what really piqued our interest to start looking more closely at that data.
So you launched a separate survey of these women who left, specifically focusing on big law firms, to gather insights on what happened. And I know you sort of touched on that just now, but did you have any assumptions going into the survey of what happened? And did that hold true?
Well, as we looked at those numbers of women that we didn't know what happened.
I'm sure it was shocking.
It was shocking. And they didn't return to a top 200 firm. Everybody's pretty much, said the same thing. They said, oh, it's the pandemic. Oh, it's children at home. They had to go take care of the children. And I said, well, we really can't assume that. We really should see if we could validate or invalidate that theory. And really the only way we could do it was to do a survey. So we sent out a survey specifically trying to target women who had left a top law firm and who would be willing to tell us about their experiences and why they left.
I know that, we heard a lot through the pandemic, and you mentioned it just now, that, women were affected during the pandemic much worse than it did their male counterparts. And in fact, sometimes, and I kind of cringe at this, but it was referred to as the she session, right, for the recession. But for many women, there was this whole idea that they were taking care of children, they were taking care of their elderly family members, that And that was often cited as the reason that they were not returning to work. Was that what you found, was that it was just that, or I'm assuming it's much more than that?
Well, our data itself told us that there was not a she session. There was not a mass exodus of women from law firms. It just didn't happen. But it was a very clever term that people continued to use for a long time because it was cute, but it just didn't happen. And the women that took our survey really left for the same reasons women have been leaving law firms for years, and that is a lack of support, lack of opportunity, lack of flexibility, and work-life balance.
So focusing on that for a second, we all hear about law firm culture and how firms talk about culture as a selling point for recruitment. For the women you surveyed, however, culture may not be quite the selling point that law firms think it is. What comments did you get from the women who left law firms about their frustration in the workplace?
Well, first of all, I just have to say that, you know, culture, law firm culture is probably the most overused phrase when people are trying to describe what their law, what does it even mean? What does it mean exactly, a great law firm culture? Law firm culture is seen in the eye of the beholder, and not everyone sees the same thing. Right? If they did, there would not be issues for women or ethnically diverse attorneys. I mean, really, what your law firm culture is truly seen by the people on the lowest totem pole of your law firm. You know, the people in the upper echelon, they can have an ideal of what their culture is, but it really comes down to how they treat the people that work for them, what they require of them, what they're praised for, what they're punished for. So according to the women who answered our survey, the culture at a lot of these top law firms is pretty dismal for women. Now, it can be great for the people on the top, but for a lot of the people at the law firm, that law firm, quote unquote, culture isn't working for them. And there's a number of reasons for that. You know, let's think about the smallest things, right? A woman goes on maternity leave and is taken off the partner track and put on the mommy track after that. She's being punished for taking maternity leave, is in essence what just mm-hmm. happened. Is that good law firm culture? They would never put that in a pamphlet, but the culture is determined by the actions the law firm takes. And if someone feels punished by taking maternity leave or family leave or not, you know, turning in the number of hours that they felt that they should because they have something else going on in their life, that really points to a culture that's not going to be good for a lot of people.
There was one part of the survey that really caught my eye, and that was the issue around some of the associates who left Am Law 200 firms. The interesting thing is, and I think we've all kind of heard this over the past few years, but you know, I just want to really kind of stress this, that you know, coming out of law school, there is basically there's parity between women associates and male associates that are starting in the law firm. However, as you were going through your data and going through some of the survey, you found out that when it comes to lateral hiring of associates, so these, you know, in the 2, 3, 4 to 7 year range, all of a sudden that gender difference is strikingly apparent. What is happening to women in the lateral market that is causing such a disparity between, again, their male counterparts?
Well, it's actually a tad more interesting than that, because for the last 3 years, we have seen more women than men get hired by the top 200 law firms right out of law school. And it's been a number that's been growing in disparity each year. There are more women than men in college. There are more women than men in law schools. And now there is a trend of those firms hiring more women right out of law school. So they're gaining in those numbers. They now have parity in the firms on the associate level, but they're hiring more women than men on the entry level. But when it comes to lateral hiring, women still fall behind. They are hiring more male laterals. And why is that? That is a great question to ask the firms. That is a great question. Are they not hiring women because of bias, because of unconscious bias? I'm sure there's a lot of people that really couldn't even tell you. Now, when we get to partner numbers, and I think that was a question as well.
I was going to ask, is it the same for partner numbers?
It's even worse. The disparity between women lateral hires and male lateral hires is vast. Now, we know that there are certainly, more male partners than women, but they're not making a concerted effort to hire women partner laterals. And they are lagging behind in hiring female laterals, even on the associate level. It's a choice. It's a choice. And when you get to that hiring partner, when you get to that management committee that's going to make the choice, you're going to have a lot of really talented people to choose from. A lot of them just aren't choosing the women in the same kind of numbers that they're choosing the men.
Yeah. There was a comment you made on a webinar you did a couple of months ago that also stuck with me. And that was when it comes to lateral associates, that when an associate is brought in as a lateral, they tend to be promoted to partner at a higher percentage than the people that are there at the firm and just kind of start there and work their way to try to be partner. The way you kind of put it was it's almost like a double whammy for women, because being recruited less on the lateral front also then results in less women actually making that leap to partnership as well. Just curious, out of the people that you surveyed, are women for some reason not entering the lateral market to the same rate as their male counterparts? Or what's some of the reasoning that the numbers don't seem to be there?
I don't think it's, they were, in the year that we surveyed and we looked at 2021, they were calling everybody to lateral, right? Everybody.
I can verify
everybody
that.
Everybody in the people. You got a friend, how's your neighbor down the street? But they were still consistently hiring more men than women. And about that partnership track that we spoke of. Yes, it's very difficult for women, but it's very difficult overall. I mean, we have a report that shows the days to partnership for every firm, and there's a big difference between those that enter as a entry-level hire and those that come in as a lateral. So the number of days has increased to a dramatic degree for those who enter the firm as an entry-level attorney. And it has increased somewhat for those who entered a firm laterally, but not quite as much. I mean, it has grown 147% or some crazy thing like that since 2012. So the road to partnership has become longer. It's become harder. And our data shows that it's easier for those to make partner who move laterally into a firm. And for women, they have that extra problem now, and that is not as many women laterals are being hired. So they're not getting the opportunity, on that level either.
I know for sure that the time from fall associate to making partner, I think when I first came in, there was like a 5-year mark. Then there was a 6,
yeah,
and now 7, now 8. And then on top of that, you've also got, non-equity partner versus equity partner. And how long does it take?
There's just more steps in between.
Just more steps. That's right.
One of the other things that you mentioned was that in 2021, there was a significant increase in younger women attorneys suddenly leaving Am Law 200 firms. So what kind of numbers are you seeing, and what's the reasoning behind this uptick in departures of younger women attorneys?
Well, what we saw in 2021 was, yes, there was a large uptick from that age group, which was 25 to 30, that exited a top 200 firm. Mm-hmm. But On the reverse side, there was also an uptick in that same age group of them re-entering a top 200 firm. So those younger women were actually making a career move. They left one top 200 firm and moved into another top 200 firm. The group that actually didn't fare as well returning into a top 200 firm was that next age group, which was 31 to 35. And I think, you know, we all sort of know in our head that the local wisdom has always been, it's that mid-career associate that leaves. It's that, that's when women leave, is mid-career. And this data really, really bears that out. So those younger women are moving for a career move. They, you know, a good number of them stayed within the top 200 firms, but that next group, 31 to 35, a larger number of them did not return to a top 200 firm. Mm-hmm. So mid-career, that's where the problem really seems to be.
So I want to read something from your report that really speaks to the barriers that women lawyers and law firms face in advancing their careers. And I will warn our listeners, there's some triggering language in here. At least it was triggering for me. But this is the quote. Women lawyers have substantially less access to the building blocks needed for long-term success in firm practice. Far more than men, and simply on account of their gender, women experience demeaning comments, lack access to business developmental opportunities, have been overlooked for advancement, lack access to sponsors, and suffer other behaviors in firms that diminish their chances for reaching the same level of success as their male colleagues. That's a pretty powerful statement on what you found through the survey results. Why is it that law is still so biased when it comes to how it treats its women lawyers over how it treats its male lawyers?
Well, that's, yeah, that's the $1 million.
The $24,000 question. Yeah.
I topped you with my $1 million. But I think that particular quote may have come from an article that we also quoted, which was Walking Out the Door, which was a really great article. But the women that answered our survey echoed all of those comments. As a matter of fact, when we did the survey, the results were so depressing that we really had to sit on them for a while. And we had asked a number of women that answered the survey, you know, can we reach out to you and talk? And we did. We didn't end up using their comments because they were so raw and tough. They were tough to hear. That's when we decided to reach out to women who had succeeded, who had made partner in a top 200 firm, and see what their firms were doing or what helped them to succeed. But as for those comments and as for all of those terrible things that we heard and read that, you know, came out from the survey, for the law firms, in my opinion, it's a choice. It is a choice. It is a conscious choice. You can declare that you are a great workplace for women and ethnic minorities and you got great culture. But until you take really concrete steps to ensure that you've got a great workplace for women, it won't be. Because fighting bias is hard. Fighting unconscious bias is even harder, especially if you don't know it exists. It takes education, it takes effort, and it takes will. But then once you apply all of those, you can really make changes structurally in your firm and make changes in hearts and minds. And that's where a lot of these changes have to take place.
So I wanted to follow up on that. You had mentioned that you reached out to women who succeeded. Was there any indication as to what their organizations did right that helped them, or was it simply they just kind of muscled through?
I'm sure there are many women out there that muscled through,
especially,
you know, especially before we see some of these women empowerment programs pop up in firms. But for the women that we talked to, I was so happy to hear, you know, what's going on at the law firms. But let me also say one thing. Most of the great stories we're going to hear about what's going on in law firms that help women succeed were all started by women. And most of them are run by women. So women supporting women makes a huge difference all across the board for women in law firms. But we heard from, you know, people at Lowenstein about using the amplification strategy. We learned about, you know, programs that help women make equity partner. There are some really great programs out there that women who have walked this path helped develop to help put a hand down and help their sisters up, because it's tough and they're not getting it from the men. They have to get it from somewhere or they're all going to fail. So women stepped up to help other women. And that was another really exciting part of what we discovered.
Excellent.
One of the things that I came away with the survey was that you developed 11 ways in which law firms can tear down these barriers that exist for women lawyers. So I just want to take some time right now and just walk through some examples that you have and walk through those 11 tasks that law firms can be doing. And the first one is to let women speak. So what do you mean by letting women speak?
Well, there are some great examples about, you know, how women get talked over in different meetings. They raise their hand. They don't get called on. And over at Lowenstein, they really adopted something that they did during the Obama administration. Women in the room saw that they weren't being heard. So they banded together. And when someone talked over a woman, they would say, "That's great, Bob, but let's let Cheryl finish her point." Or, you know, someone comes up with a great idea, a woman puts it forth, no one pays attention to it. 10 minutes later, a man says the same thing and everybody says, "Oh, it's a brilliant idea." Well, they have their team in the room and they say, "Yes, Bob, that is a great idea. And it was also great when Cheryl brought that up 10 minutes ago. So let's look at that." Right. Mm-hmm. So it does a couple of things. It makes people notice what they've done and it makes people listen to what those women have to say. So that's a really great strategy.
Okay. So number two is give women opportunities. And I don't know. I imagine this is more complicated than it sounds, since I know firms sort of struggle with this in terms of how to staff different matters and things like that.
Exactly. Well, it's complicated. And I want to say, while this applies, and this survey was all about women, some of these strategies also can be applied to those ethnically diverse attorneys mm-hmm. at the firm too, to make sure they're getting the same kind of opportunities. So we talked to Christy Tosh Kreider at Baker Donaldson, and she heads the healthcare litigation group there. And she started the Women's Initiative at her firm. And they also started a program to help women get to equity partnership, to really take their hand and tell them what they have to do and what they should do and who they should work with. They really just lead them through the whole process. And over at Lowenstein, they have a different process. Elaine Hughes told us about, they have a centralized database where they can actually measure who is getting what opportunity, who hasn't worked with this particular partner yet, and who should be given the opportunity to do so. So once you measure and track who is getting opportunities at the firm, you can begin to see very clearly who isn't. And then they take steps to make sure that those people get the same opportunities that others have been offered.
Mm-hmm. Now, step three, you have give women a seat at the table. And we have a saying around here that we borrowed is, if you're not at the table, you're on the menu. And so I imagine it. And I think this probably goes back to something that you said earlier, and that is, these successes that you read and hear about typically are a result of women-led initiatives where they were given the power. And just on a side note, there was a survey or a study that came out 4 or 5 years ago that said that the more women you have on the compensation committee, the higher the compensation is for women, that there's a direct result. So I imagine this is in that same vein.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Of course, that would be true. But there's also other things that happen at the firm and decisions that get made, and women should be in the room for those decisions. You know, how they deal with maternity leave, how they deal with issues that affect women, whether it's what provider they go for healthcare or anything else. If a man at the firm is making decisions that are going to affect women's health, women's lives, women's responsibilities, that really sort of has a sense of paternalism to it, right? And they also may not really understand what those women need. They may think they do, or they may think it's the same as for the men, but it's really not. So having a seat at the table that will help men make better decisions for their female employees is really, really important. Because what will that lead to? That will also lead to better retention of those employees. So having a seat at the table is incredibly important.
Number four is don't tolerate sexism, which again, sounds pretty straightforward and clear cut, but I imagine is not. I think, you know, you talk to a bunch of different people as to what sexism is or isn't, and you'll get just as many different answers. So, that's, you know, right. how does a firm approach that?
Well, there are several types of sexism, right? There, we've talked about the microaggressions and all those small things and unconscious bias, which we'll talk about later. But blatant, out in the open sexism, that can be stopped. I mean, I really didn't.
Still happening, or are people more sophisticated about it?
There was a survey that said it is still happening today, and there's only one reason why it is, and that's because it's tolerated. If it was not tolerated, it would not exist. So more than anything, this is the easiest thing to stop, is that overt sexism. When you hear it, you call it out. When you hear it, you take that attorney aside and you say, I never want to hear you speak that way again. It has to be nipped in the bud and it has to be stopped right there. And it would be great if other people saw it happen, because they would know that's not tolerated here. And that's really the only way to deal with it, is just to make a choice to end it.
It's going to be interesting, because we've mentioned this a lot on the show over the past couple of years, and that is with Gen X, that they tend to be the ones who will call out this type of behavior right on the spot, right in public.
Gen Z.
Or I'm sorry, Gen Z. And so I think it's going to be interesting over the next few years, as more and more Gen Zs come into the workforce, that you're going to see more of this, you know, calling out things right on the spot. So that's going to be a shock to a lot of the senior people.
And it would be a shock. But what would really put a nail in this coffin is if leadership didn't tolerate it and they were the ones that spoke up. That's what will stop it. You know, they might be afraid of some sort of lawsuit when Gen Z says it, and they might say something in private that they don't say in public. But if they really wanted to stop it, it's the leadership that would stop it and say, we don't tolerate that. And that group I do want to talk about later, that Gen Z and millennials as well. There's going to be a number of surprises for law firms, I think.
Yeah.
That'll be in the crystal ball.
So number five was uncover unconscious bias. And before I let you answer this one, there's a lot going on, not just in law firms, but I'd say culturally across, especially the United States, that when you say unconscious bias, people get very defensive on that, because I think they see it primarily as it's bad behavior, and I don't, you know, and that's,
you're
not
calling
me
a bad person.
Yeah, you're calling me a bad person. And so when a law firm looks to change and find out what kind of unconscious bias that they have, what do you see as a way to kind of get over that hump of unconscious bias means I'm a bad person, and I'm not a bad person, therefore I don't have unconscious bias?
Right. Well, I think it's safe to say that we all have unconscious biases of many things. but it's when you bring that into the light that you become aware of it, and then you can start to address it. So when we talked to Christy Tosh Kreider, Baker Donaldson, they have groups, they have people that come in and work with people in leadership to train them on their unconscious biases and how they can work to overcome them. But the first thing they have to do is recognize that they're there. It doesn't make them a bad person. It's something everyone on the planet has. But in this case, in this particular instance, that unconscious bias could really lead to you not promoting a woman over a man. You not hiring a female lateral over a male lateral, and training and then a consistent strategy, you know, that follows that are really critical to help firms overcome this issue. And this is a big issue. And again, this really isn't just about women. You could apply the same thing to those ethnically diverse attorneys. So uncovering unconscious bias would be a real help to the firm. And there are some great training programs out there, but leadership has to do it. It's not just all the underlings. Leadership has to do it and be aware of it.
Number six was offering equal paternity care. Now, is the thought that this is going to like level the playing field? You know, moms and dads get equal time. Do you think it will, if it's offered, will it actually be taken?
Well, that's part of the problem, right? So it is about leveling the playing field in a sense. It's about destigmatizing taking maternity leave. And if everyone took it, if men took it, if women took it, it really would help to destigmatize that maternity leave, right? But it can't just be associates. So, and there's a lot, partners have to take it as well, right? So there's all kinds of leave. There's maternity leave, there's paternity leave, but then there's time when you have an ill parent or you have something else that you have to take leave for. It's very important that leadership take these types of leaves because that signals to everyone else at the firm that it's okay to do it, that you're not going to be punished for taking it. I had a call today with an attorney who said when she started at the firm, you know, she wasn't at the point where she needed maternity leave, but she hoped to in the upcoming year. And when she saw a female partner do it, she felt, oh, okay, then I'm not going to be penalized for taking it. So I'll feel okay about taking it in the future. So much of all of these things depends on leadership, because leaders are supposed to lead, right? And their actions can signal what's okay, what's approved, what's normal at a firm. If they're taking paternity leave, if a male partner is taking paternity leave, then they know that their associates are going to know it's okay to take paternity leave. And it's the same, of course, for female partners and women associates. It's very important that leadership do this as well and let everyone know that it's okay to do it.
This next one, I know we've done a lot more on this since the pandemic, but I mean, it's not necessarily, wasn't created during the pandemic, and that was to offer flex time schedules and remote work. So how does that help?
Well, women have been asking to work from home forever. And the answer was always no, 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 no. And it took a pandemic to change that. So here we are. Now we can all work from home. Of course, there are a lot of law firms that are trying to, you know, reverse that now, put that genie back in the bottle. But everyone really loves it because it affords them a bit of a life. But that's not the end all be all, because if you're working 85 hours a week and you're working from home, you can wave to your family across the room, and that's about it, because you don't have time to do much more. And that's where flex time comes in. And there are not a lot of firms offering flex time in a way that can really work for women and people that are having, you know, family difficulties too. But when I talked to Molly Singer over at Gibson Dunn, she had a great story. She said she realized that she was going to have to do something just so she could manage her life and her family and her kids. And she went to her managing partner and she said, I'm going to have to leave or I really do need to request to go part-time. And he said, I would rather have you 50% of the time than most of those associates out there 100% of the time. So she went on a flex time schedule. She made partner while on a flex time schedule. And every year there are people that make partners on that flex time schedule. It's about the work. It's about the work that you deliver. And it allows her to continue to have a good family life and good home life. That is an exciting story. That is an exciting story. You know, working from home, yes, we all like that. But there's a bit more to it. And working, you know, an insane number of hours while you're at home might let you enjoy that home a little bit. But there are times, whether it's for childcare, if it's taking care of a sick parent, taking care of a sick spouse, there are times that anyone, you know, might need that ability just to dial down the work hours. And again, if a partner did the same thing, that would signal to everyone else at the firm that it was okay to do that. Promoting people while they're on flex time is a great signal that you're not going to be punished, you know, for moving to a flex time schedule. So that was a very exciting story.
That's excellent.
Yeah. And on top of that, they were enabled to keep her. They didn't have to replace her, which... And you've mentioned that, you know, when it comes to losing attorneys and recruiting and bringing in and training new attorneys, that there's a huge dollar amount that goes into that. And so I imagine allowing flex time allows you to pay someone a little less, but, you know, be able to retain them. So I think, you know, that's one of those things where I'm just surprised that we haven't done more of that.
I agree. Retention of women associates, ethically diverse associates, all associates, retention is not good. There are millions and millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars lost every year with bad retention. And they spend a lot more money to get the next group to come back in to fill those slots. And if they don't stay, they go do the same thing again. So there's a huge cycle there of spending all kinds of money to replace people that they should have held on to in the beginning. You can't replace a mid-level person who exits a firm with someone coming right out of law school. You're going to have to go find someone with that experience, pay out the wazoo for it, and then hope their integration and they can bring those clients. That's a lot. That's a lot. So much
it's
better
a big risk
to keep those people that are serving you well and to keep them in, you know, whatever manner that you can. Flex time, let them work from home, give them what they need, and then you don't get into that horrible money churn replacing people who left.
So the next one on the list is acknowledging women's successes. And I love this one because this really is simple. You know, it's like you really, you know, it's like that doesn't require a lot of money to do. It doesn't require, you know, it just requires being thoughtful, really. So I was happy to see it's like, you know, pretty much anybody can do this. So,
well, they can, but even during our webinar, when we had, you know, we were talking about this and saying, you know, women are notoriously bad for saying, yep, I did that. Yep, I did that. There were women that were typing in the chat and said, I get punished when I do that. Everyone thinks I'm, you know, not a good person when I do that. So there's still this stigma. Men can do it easily. Yep, I did that. Everybody pats him on the back. It doesn't seem to be the same experience for women. But overall, what we've learned from a few law firms was that clients are now driving some accountability on that front. And they want to know who exactly is working on their matters and what they're doing. is it a diverse group of people, be it gender diverse or ethnically diverse? So that is really sort of forcing the issue. And if those clients find out that you are not attributing women for their work, or, you know, those who are, you know, diverse for their work, then they'll just pick up their ball and go to another law firm and start playing mm-hmm. with them. So
that's right.
This kind of accountability, I think, will really push firms to make sure that women are acknowledged for all of their participation and all of their work in matters. It's kind of a shame that you have to have clients do it, but it's something that can really drive this home to a firm, because, again, it's all about, it's about money. So they'll pick up and, mm-hmm. and their ears will pick up and they listen to that. But it's something that's really important. And now it's really important to their clients. So hopefully that'll make it really important for the firm.
To them too.
Yeah. One of the quickest ways to drive change in a law firm is to have it come from the client. So.
And tie it to money.
Number 9 on the list is ensure fairness in promotions, which, I mean, on its face sounds very simple, but how does a firm ensure the fairness of promotions?
Well, you know, again, it's about that support. It's about making sure that people understand these people really deserve to be promoted. For that, you have to look at some of the other points to make sure that, you know, what they've done has been acknowledged, that the work that they've done, the clients that they've brought in, the money that they've made the firm has all been acknowledged. And there have been some unequal standards when it comes to promotions and when it comes to lateral hiring as well. That's something that you really have to have. How can I say this? You really have to put more thought into your promotion process and to make sure that it's not biased in any way against women or those who are ethnically diverse. And they have to look at all the data points that we've talked about so far and acknowledge their successes, listen to what they have to say. All of those things are a part of it. And also to be aware of the numbers in their firm. So when we look at the number of women partners at a firm, we get an overall number for the top 200 is like 27% or something. Well, for some firms, that's a number that's way larger than the number of female partners at their particular firm. That's sort of the danger of averages, right? It can make things look much better overall, you know, at some firms because that number is much greater. So look, within your firm, how many women partners do you have? How many women do you promote? Because I have to tell you, this is going to be something that's really going to affect where women go in the future. When young women coming out of law school say, you have 2 women partners and you've got 120 male partners, this doesn't look like the firm for me. You know, you only promoted 1 woman in the last 3 years opposed to all the men that you have promoted. Those are all types of data that, you know, we work with law schools too. They have access to this data. And anybody can look on a firm website and see how many female partners that they have. It's not like it's a great secret, right? People are going to make decisions based on who you have in your firm and partnership. And that's something that they really have to remember around promotion time. It's going to affect more than they think.
So we talked a little bit earlier about this sort of gap in hiring women laterals. So that, of course, is a recommendation, is to hire more women laterals. Did the survey or your discussions with people, did this uncover any particular reasons or difficulties maybe that firms had in doing this? Or was it, I know you're laughing, I was like, or was it simply that, nope, they just didn't do it?
Well, I think that's part of it, frankly, because I think a lot of times when it comes down to the final choices, people like to make choices that are familiar to them. And if you have a male hiring partner, hiring a man is just more comfortable and familiar. And that's true. But there are real things that you can do. Again, Christy Tosh Kreider over at Baker Donaldson, you know, again, women helping women, right? When they hired their first sort of recruitment head for lateral attorneys, she went right over there and said, let's talk about how we can hire more women and how we can find more, you know, women laterals to hire. And I think, too, it goes back to some of the other points that we had. They may not even realize that that's what they're doing, but that's what mm-hmm. they're doing. So making sure that they understand their numbers, not that this is a quota system, but understand who you hire in the past. And if you're looking at two candidates that have virtually the same qualifications, virtually the same amount of business that they can bring your firm, is there a reason why you're choosing the man over the woman? That's really sort of the bottom line. And that's what they have to kind of ferret out. And women at the firm can help ask those questions. If you have a woman on the promotion committee, what does that do? That helps to ask the question, why aren't we promoting women? So giving those women a seat at the table. You know, and over again, Christy Tosh Kreider, they're doing such great things. She actually built that Women to Equity program to help women, you know, make partner. But she had to do it because it wasn't being done, and had to build an extra highway to get those women on, to get them to that track. Well, making sure that your lateral hiring team knows that you are interested in hiring women, that's step one. Why don't you look for some women that could also fill this role? It's the same thing they did with diverse candidates. Why? Because clients were saying, why don't you have more diverse people in your law firm? And then all of a sudden they said, let's go find some diverse candidates. Well, they should do the same thing for women. Why not look for women? Why not look for men? And then judge on their qualifications. But be aware that they're not being hired at your firm at a great rate, or just be aware that you need to look at all of the options in front of you.
And last but not least, the final point was to focus on mentoring. So what kind of mentoring do law firms need to do to help their women attorneys get success?
Well, they need to do it, first of all. I think there's a lot of firms that say they have a mentorship program. You're assigned, you know, a partner. So once, twice a year, you might hear from him, how's it going? How's it going? That's really not mentorship, right? You really have to have sort of a structured program for mentorship. And over at Gibson Dunn, you know, Molly Singer told us a great story about the mentorship program over there. She was given an appellate partner to work with, a very important partner, very big partner in the firm. She had a really silly question she had to ask him, like, what color the paper should she use on this appellate work to file? And she could go ask him without fear. She could go ask him and not worry about feeling foolish in front of him. And he was tremendously helpful to her all throughout her career. Over at Baker Donaldson, they actually have two mentorship programs. They have one that the firm sets up for everyone in the firm, and they have a separate one just for women. For women helping women at the firm. And let's face it, when you go to law school, you come out, you don't know what you're doing. You don't know how to do your job. And you could be at a law firm for several years before you realize that you're supposed to be putting together a book of business. What? What are you talking about? I've been busy working on all these other matters. I'm not developing my own business. Now I got to do it. All of these things need to be told to them at the right time so they can really prepare for the long term. Right? Yes, you need to do your work. But at the same time, you need to be cultivating people that you could bring in as clients. There's all kinds of things that people know because they've spent a lifetime in law that they could impart to people to help them be successful. Every year, they hire people from the best and brightest schools and the best GPAs, and they get them in, and then they say, good luck. Mm-hmm. It's sink or swim. Well, you want everybody to swim. You want everybody to swim. You don't want, you know, people drowning in the shallow end. But that's what happens year after year after year, because they're not getting enough support at the firm. And if they had a real robust mentorship program, there would be fewer deaths in the shallow end, and there would be a lot more people swimming to the finish line.
I like that. Like everybody, you want everybody to swim, because I think traditionally it's been, you know, let's see who floats. And that was sort of the way of determining who stays and who didn't. But I think that approach is somewhat outdated, you know, given what we're talking about here. So,
and given the costs involved,
right,
the costs involved of losing those people are higher than partnership realizes.
You've taken the time to make these choices and say, okay, these are the people. And, you know, if you've done your job appropriately, and let's assume you have, like, you want to nurture all of them. You want them all, because that's just better for you and them.
Exactly. It's a better human decision, and it's a better business decision.
That's right. Win-win.
Win-win.
So, Laura, we ask all our guests to look into their crystal ball and tell us what they see in the next 2 to 5 years. So I'll ask you, you know, what do you see in the next 2 to 5 years when it comes to women leaving the law? You know, what are the changes and challenges you see for the industry in the next few years?
Well, there was something mentioned by a few women that took our survey. And that was, I realized I didn't want to be partner. And there was another comment that said, as an associate, I was working tremendous hours all to become partner. And I finally realized, what do I get? I work the same amount of hours, if not more, and I have administrative duties piled on top of it. It's not worth it. So this is what women are saying now. They're seeing it and they're leaving. They're leaving in greater numbers than men are, right? You also have that Gen Z, and you've got that millennial group too, that are beginning to say, yeah, that's not what I want. That's not what I want. It's really a bad bargain. You know, you come in and you work yourself to death for a number of years. Maybe you'll make partner, maybe you won't. That road is getting longer and longer and steeper every year. And then when you make it, what do you get? The pandemic did a number of things, right? For one thing, it gave us that remote work that we talked about. It also gave us signing documents on DocuSign. We've got courts that are doing cases over Zoom. None of that would have happened for another 50 years in law firms, because they would have resisted it all the way. So they were forced to make that change. I think they're going to be forced to make some other changes as a group of young attorneys and female attorneys say, yeah, it's not worth it. So the road that's laid out in front of them is so unappealing and so unappetizing that they're not going to stay. So they're really going to lose that workhorse associate that's going to be there through their career to hopefully make partner. The big problem here is the billable hour. I mean, let's just say it right out. That's why you have to work 85 hours a week. That's why you have to work these insane hours. It's that billable hour. The billable hour is making the tippy-top partnership a lot of money. But at the same time, the billable hour is costing in ROI on hiring for entry levels, for laterals. It's really costing them more money than they realize. And the money that they could save by retention, those dollars spend the exact same way than all the dollars that come in from the billable hour. They spend the same exact way. And that's something that they're going to have to understand. I was at a seminar just a few months ago when I talked to a group of mid-sized law firms. And we actually had one of the managing partners on a webinar with us talking about, you know, now all we do is alternative fee arrangements. Our clients love it. It has made such a tremendous difference in our firm in getting clients to use us, and also in retention. But for them, it was a huge moneymaker, because it you know who else hates the billable hour? Clients. Clients really hate the billable hour. So this is something that everybody hates, yet we keep it because a small group at the top of the pyramid think they're making a lot of money on it. But if they really considered the overall picture, the billable hour is actually costing them a lot. So unless my crystal ball is completely wrong, there's going to have to be some changes within how a law firm is built. You know, when we looked at the numbers leaving, right, this whole thing has been about women leaving law. So 62% of women that left a top 200 law firm rejoined a top 200 law firm. Well, 39.35% of men, the same. So if you look at the opposite side of that, that says about 60% of men who leave a top 200 firm don't go back to one. About 64% of women that left a top 200 firm don't go back to one. That's a problem. That's a problem. And that's one that's going to become more evident over time. And I hope they have the courage to do something about it.
You and a bunch of other people are hoping mm-hmm. that as well. So, well, Laura Leppard from Leppard Solutions, I want to thank you very much for coming in and talking to us today. Before we let you go, can you let the listeners know where they can find out more about what you're doing there at Leppard Solutions?
Of course. You can visit our website, leopardsolutions.com. You can also get a copy of this white paper there, along with other studies that we've done. And it's free. You just go and download it. You can read all of this material. It's really eye-opening. And we're going to keep talking about it. We're going to keep looking at it. We're going to keep reporting on it. And we're going to hope that we see some change.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Laura.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So we want everybody to swim, you know? I mean, it's
yes.
It's that easy, you know? Yeah, we got to look out for other people. We got to be aware of what in our business culture, our culture at large, our personal behavior is thwarting that.
Yeah. And one of the things that I think Laura stressed on this was, even though this survey was focused on women attorneys, and especially in the Am Law 200 firm, that it has application for everyone. I mean, there are things in here that are just plain common sense when it comes mm-hmm. to, you know, working with other people, especially when you're on a track for promotion over a number of years. And so I think there's a lot in this for everyone to learn from.
Exactly.
So thanks again to Laura Leppard from Leppard Solutions for coming on the show. And again, we'll have links out to the website and to the survey so that you can learn more.
And thanks to all of you for taking the time to listen to the Geek & Review podcast. If you enjoy the show, share it with a colleague. We'd love to hear from you, so reach out to us on social media. I can be found at GabeBauerM on Twitter.
And I can be reached at Glambert on Twitter.
Or you can leave us a voicemail on the Geek & Review hotline at 713-487-7270. And as always, the music you hear is from Jerry David DeSica. Thank you, Jerry.
Thanks, Jerry. All right, Marlene, I will talk with you later.
All right, bye-bye.